People sometimes ask me to distinguish between Yogananda's path and many of the other choices that you have these days, especially where we live here in California. One of my friends said it's like a spiritual candy store. You have all these different choices if you live in the middle of the country or in a less sophisticated, culturally sophisticated area. You don't really have as many options as you have here. So people will find a little bit of benefit from this and a little bit from that and all these different ways of choosing. And then you have to decide. Well, there's many characteristics of Yogananda's path. But one of them was described just beautifully in just one line of this particular reading, is that this is very much a path of the heart. And that's not always so easy to perceive or so easy to understand what the implications of it are. Because the other side of it is the teachings themselves are very subtle and extremely intelligently presented. When you sit and read Swami Kriyananda's books, you know, the thoughts are, he writes very simply, but the thoughts are indeed very complicated. And in fact, about a decade ago, I started teaching various classes based on his books, and not merely a sort of superficial summary of his books, but going page by page very slowly. And in fact, when I did like almost 2 years on the Bhagavad Gita commentary, I had still set a standard of 10 pages a week, and I decided that was just an appalling discipline to have to meet, because there was so much in each section sometimes that having to race through was very painful. So after that, I've just set classes as open-ended. We're doing Patanjali's Yoga Sutras now, and it will simply take us as long as it takes us. Because what is our hurry, really? Where is there to go? We're trying to get to infinity. If it takes us a couple of months longer, what does it matter? But the reason I started these was because I was actually reading in the first book was Hindu Way of Awakening. Swami Kriyananda has turned out so many different books in his life that they just sort of rise and then go backstage almost as the next one comes in front of it. Well, the Hindu Way of Awakening was a real watershed book, because he was making an effort to really explain the underlying truth of what is called Hinduism that is often so confused by the gods and goddesses and all of the symbolism that they have and all the rituals associated with them. And I mean, being a Westerner, I only know it just a tiny bit, but enough to be very confused. And when I was reading The Hindu Way, I was having to concentrate very deeply to understand what Swamiji was saying. And I thought, this is not an easy book to understand. And I realized that probably most people don't, and that we should really sit together and really try to understand it. So with that level of intellectual sophistication, sometimes we begin to think of this path in terms of all these wonderful ideas. But Master, when he was living and he had the same extraordinary power of articulation, everything that Swamiji writes is based on what he learned from Master, that Master always brought it back, and he brought it back to the single word attunement. And emphasizing that today in this phrase, abide in God, we're talking about how we feel about our whole experience of life. And it's not really a question of what we think about our experience of life, because we're not really moved by what we think. Or let me phrase it differently. Reason always follows feeling. Whatever feeling we are predisposed to have, then we always find reasons to support it. I'm sure you have had the experience that I've had from time to time, trying to help someone who feels depressed. And when someone has decided that life is difficult and they themselves are unworthy perhaps, or you know, everything produces sadness, then everything produces sadness. And you have the frustrating experience of trying to reason someone out of a predisposition of the heart. And eventually, by the grace of God, somehow something will shift that heart, and then all of a sudden, you see everything differently. Watch yourself. Watch your mind. Watch it make up reasons why you're not any good at this or not any good at that, or why this is disappointing and that is disappointing. And when your mood shifts, all of a sudden our whole perception of reality shifts. Now, one of the characteristics of this path, especially as Ananda expresses it, is all the music that we sing and all the chants that we sing. And I want to thank you today, the chanting group. You were really just beautiful, listening from the minister's room. I am the bubble, make me the sea, thou and I, never apart. And that's such a simple statement. And you can say it in words, thou and I, never apart. But when you add it to the melody, music goes in a completely different part of our brain. And we are, even though we don't realize it, we are nothing but vibrations. Even the scientists who have no regard or no thinking about God talk to us about that now. That what appears to be the material world is merely energy vibrating at different frequencies. Much of subtle healing now is about energy vibrating at different frequencies. And music itself, you see, is a vibration. And when we listen, and when we sing together, and when we sit in a room and sing together, what happens is we all enter into that particular vibration. And that's why just chanting or listening to chanting for just a short period of time, all of a sudden there's an entirely different feeling about everything, because we have literally become the vibration that we're listening to. So I was somewhere not too long ago, and they were playing a Beatles song. And I grew up on the Beatles and was very fond of them. And it was that song about lonely people. They wrote a song about lonely people. And they were very good at their music. They knew exactly what they wanted to say, and they said it really, really well. Whether it was worth saying is another question. Whether it was enduring truth or only temporary was something we'll have to wait and see. Swami Kriyananda said he was always charmed by John Lennon when he was asked once, do you think the Beatles' music will live on? And John Lennon said, why should it? Just like that. And whether it did or not was not a question, but Swamiji enjoyed the fact that he didn't take himself too seriously. But that particular song, which I won't repeat any of it, even if I could, was so intensely painful to listen to that I had to walk out of, I think it was a store, I just had to walk out of the store, because they had found the thread of human anguish, and they were personifying it as loneliness. And the vibration was so exact as to what that particular human emotion feels like that I couldn't bear to stay there and listen to it. Because, you see, it was the exact suffering, but at least in that particular song, it did not resolve itself into bliss. And that's the great and difficult challenge of life. The suffering of it is self-evident. And in the position that I am often of receiving the confidences of people and the experiences that they have in their lives, it's not always easy, the things that happen to people. Swami Kriyananda had a peculiar habit that I never completely comprehended, but I was touched when he explained it to me. Whenever he would buy a book, especially a non-fiction book, often when he would travel, he'd go to the bookstore in an airport and look for some book to pass the hours on an airplane. And he would always read the end of the book first before he'd decide whether to buy it. And why do you do that, Swamiji? He said, I've had so much sorrow in my life, he said, both of his own challenges and all that he's had to bear for others. He said, I can't bear to read unhappy stories. He said, before I start it, I want to know if it ends happily. And if it doesn't end happily, I don't want to read it. I said, well, doesn't it spoil the suspense? He said, well, as a writer, I find it intriguing to see how they're going to get there. But the point of that story was the other half of it. I don't want to read a story that ends unhappily. And also, you see, it's a contradiction of the truth. Now, that doesn't mean that one incarnation doesn't end unhappily. And very often, in trying to help people through the difficulties of their lives, A woman wrote to me once, and she was in love with someone who was not going to return her affection. And she desperately wanted to marry him, and it was clear that he was not going to marry her. And I think she wanted me to give her some manifestation technique, you know, to promise her that if she did this and that and this and that, and I couldn't do it because it seemed self-evident to me that that particular chapter was going to have, from her point of view, an unhappy ending. And we can't make ourselves feel good by telling ourselves lies. I remember a friend of mine was deeply betrayed by someone, and she had a tremendous effort to overcome that sense of betrayal. And finally she went to Swamiji and said, "Well, you know, what happened to me was just the right thing. It was just what everyone had to do. It was just the right thing." And Swami said, "No, it wasn't." Just like that. He said, "People behave dishonorably." He said, "You can't make yourself feel better by not facing the truth." He said, "Real freedom comes when you can look right at reality as it is, when you can see the truth, at least in this, on this plane, as it really is, and then expand your consciousness around it. So that even though that spot is as black as ever, it no longer is the definition of your reality." How do we do that? We do that by abiding in God. Because no matter how painful it may be in the short run, and unfortunately the short run could be an incarnation or two, Swamiji said there was a friend of his who was a monk at Mount Washington with him who was prone to very dark moods. And the man was sitting on the bed in Swami's room, sort of in one of these very, very heavy moods. And they were both young men in their 20s. And Swamiji sought to comfort him. "There, there," he said, "how long can it last?" Speaking of his whole lifetime, 40, 50 years. And the young man, instead of being comforted by this, which Swamiji thought was very comforting, he said, ran screaming from the room. But compared to eternity, and I said to Swamiji once, he was struggling with his health, and there were also some heavy circumstances in other people's lives that he was having to deal with. "How are you, sir?" He said, "Well, not so well, but compared to eternity, I'm fine." Now that's what it is to abide in God, is to measure everything by eternity. But we can't get there just with our minds. 40, 50 years seems like a really long time. But it doesn't in that moment when we are singing, "Thou and I never apart. Wave of the sea, dissolve in the sea." In that moment, you see, our vibration moves over from the oscillating waves, literally, of up and down life, in which often it's star-crossed and it doesn't resolve happily. And we move instead into attunement with that power and presence of God, which even though, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you are always with me. We can't know that just as an idea, but if we find it as a vibration, that's what attunement is. Attunement music is the perfect image of attunement. We find that beautiful note and we sing it. And we sing it again and again and again, and we use it as the constant antidote to the other vibrations, whether it's a painful Beatles song that simply finds the suffering but doesn't in that moment also give us the joy, or if it's the reality of our own lives that, well, this is really how it's going to turn out. But abide in God, find that attunement, become the wave and the sea. And then even the little experience of the wave is completely different when it's living on the wave, on the whole ocean. "Thou and I never apart," you see, and then everything is different.